I'm John Kroll. Today, this year marks the 500th anniversary of the Reformation. Today on No Limits, we're going to explore the impact of the Reformation has had on faith communities and the entire world. My guests are Father Rick Genther, pastor at Our Lady of Lourdes, Indianapolis, the Reverend Nathan Wilson, communications director for the Christian Theological Seminary, and Robert Saylor, executive director of CTS's Center for Pastoral Excellence. Please join the conversation. Call 866-476-3881, email nolimits@wfyi.org, find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI, or track us down on Twitter at WFYI. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. This year marks the 500th anniversary of the Protestant Reformation. The Reformation, as it often is known when we talk colloquially about it. I can't talk today. If you want to join the conversation, we're going to be talking a lot about faith, about the impact of the Reformation on the modern world, and really how it shapes the world in which we live and how we believe these days. If you want to join that conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or track us down on Twitter at WFYI. My guests are Father Rick Genther. He is the pastor at Our Lady of Lourdes here in Indianapolis. The Reverend Nathan Wilson, who is Communications Director for Christian Theological Seminary, and our returning guest, Dr. Robert Saylor, who is Executive Director of CTS's Center for Pastoral Excellence. Welcome to the two of you. Welcome back to Rob. It's good to have you here.
Great to be here. Thank you.
So I've learned in doing this show, it's sort of, I do this drill actually in a classroom too when I'm teaching, so as not to make people feel embarrassed and all of that, I say, if you don't understand what I'm talking about, look down at the floor now so that they're not shamed. Because I think we often make a mistake of assuming that people understand something, which is my way of setting up the fact that I'm going to ask Rob to start us out by talking about what the Reformation is and was in broad terms, what as a historical moment, what it meant.
500 years ago in Germany, a monk named Martin Luther was trying to begin an academic dispute about a fairly arcane theological matter, and that matter was how the church has the power to forgive sins, what the relationship ultimately between our faith in God and good works are. And on the basis of beginning this academic dispute, it was as if the matter caught fire across a number of institutions, first in Europe and then spreading beyond. And the result of that really was, in the Western Church, of a thoroughgoing revision of things like worship, the role of Christian vocation, what the understanding of the priesthood is. All of these matters, which were so central to the life of the church at that time, were also central to the culture, because 500 years ago, we didn't have the distinction between the church and the culture that we see now. Under Christendom, whatever happens in the church automatically has ramifications across things like economics, law, education, and so on. So I think rather than thinking about the Reformation primarily as a church event 500 years ago, it's best to think about it as a significant Western cultural and political event that continues to have ramifications in our own day.
Rick, Father Rick, if you could talk a little bit about the impact on the Roman Catholic Church, the Reformation.
It was a wake-up call, to say the least, that had actually a longer history, 200 to 300 years prior, where some of the questions that Martin Luther Calvin and Zwingli eventually addressed had already been asked. Mm-hmm. And there were those within the church who very much wanted a reform within the church and those who did not. Partly it was political and partly it was trying to hold on to the status quo. When the Reformation began itself, it seemed like it could be confined, and so Rome tried to confine it, but it got out of hand in the sense of its overreaction, if you will, and a not understanding completely of what Martin Luther was trying to say. They were talking at times at cross purposes. The result was an inability to communicate with each other. And what happened with the Roman Church was to step back, entrench, react. So eventually, through the Council of Trent, we have the Counter-Reformation, which attempts to address a number of the issues, but does not at all satisfy the reformers in the breadth or the depth of the change.
And Nathan, part of what makes this fascinating, too, is in addition to being a political, theological, social, economic kind of revolution, I don't think you can describe it in any other way than that, it's also a communications revolution, too, because part of what goes on at that point is with the relatively recent invention of the printing press, news of this could spread much more rapidly than before and to many more people than this sort of dispute might have taken place in closed rooms if it had happened a couple of centuries earlier.
And also you had the Bible now available for people to read on their own in their own language, which had a huge impact, so that no longer was there a need for an interpreter or a mediator, in a sense, between themselves and Scripture. They could read it for themselves. They could reflect on its meaning, come back to it, and so on. So that also, as a part of the communication of both Luther in the 95 Theses, but also just the whole kind of opening up of almost individual spirituality or an ability to relate individually to God and to Scripture was new and happened all at the same time, and so kind of fed into this as well.
Yeah, the anniversary of the 95 Theses is coming. We're right on the heels of that now. It's
correct.
Right, October 31st.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
If Nathan, I'm going to stay with you for a second. We've sort of talked about in large detail. What was the debate about? I mean, at some level, what were the points of contention?
Well, so like Rob started off with, that at its heart, Luther wanted to maybe broaden a little bit an understanding of sin and penitence and redemption, and how it is that one was to seek. One was to confess sin, to be penitent, and be redeemed for that sin. In addition, though, it was, again, as Rob kind of laid out, this understanding of grace and forgiveness, mm-hmm. and the value of Scripture itself, being able to rely on Scripture as the bedrock of one's faith, and read and interpret Scripture for themselves. So all of these, and I think it's remarkable that these were efforts to perhaps reform the church, not to divide the church. Mm-hmm. And, you know, of course, I approach this as the non-Lutheran, non-Roman Catholic of the group. Mm-hmm. But they were efforts at reformation, at a reforming, a changing of the church, rather than a division of the church. So then for me, it's and I think for all of us, it's remarkable that 500 years later, jointly, we are commemorating this Not celebrating it.
Yeah, but
in my mind, but
acknowledging it,
acknowledging it,
and all of that. And I do have a follow up, but go ahead, Rob.
When I was growing up in a Lutheran church, Reformation Sunday was very explicitly celebrated as, thank God we're no longer Catholic Sunday. There was a very adversarial relationship between Lutheranism and Roman Catholicism that was enshrined in this precise anniversary. Mm-hmm. And as Nathan says, it's simply remarkable, and we sit at an incredible nexus of history wherein, rather than celebrating this division now, 500 years later, both Lutherans and Roman Catholics, the Vatican and the Lutheran World Federation, are talking about commemoration. Mm-hmm. And commemoration is commemoration with an eye towards future unity. Mm-hmm. A number of important documents have been produced jointly between the Roman Catholic Church and the Lutheran World Federation. One of them is Declaration on the Way. Mm-hmm. And the on the way in that title refers to us being on the way, hopefully, towards shared communion, being able to go to the Eucharistic table together, and possibly modes of reunification that simply would have been unthinkable even 15, 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. The progress has been astounding.
Well, and I do want to talk about that. I think what I want to, because it seems to me for people to appreciate the significance of that, though, they have to understand the division. Mm-hmm. In the first place, and that's why. And I should say to our listeners, we're talking about the 500th anniversary of the Reformation today on No Limits. If you want to join the conversation, or if you've got a question, please give us a call at 866-476-3881. Send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI, or track us down on Twitter at WFYI. What I'd like to get at, though, is, you know, in the popular mind, the Reformation was about, no way to get around it, the sale of indulgences or whatever, that it was a kind of protest against what they saw as a corrupt hierarchy of the church at that time. Admittedly, I didn't live in that era. I don't approach things with the same mindset, but in my world as a journalist and all that, that would have been maybe a one-day news story. What I really want to get at is there was something about this. What was it that set minds and souls on fire here? Why, what issues were there that were so powerful that they divided people for half a millennium? Rick, I'm going to give you the first word on that, if I could.
In my reflection and reading in this area, it really came down to the struggle of what power does the church have in the forgiveness of sins, and how could that be taken to a point of abuse? Mm-hmm. Excuse me.
Flu and cold season here. We're going to ask people to deal with it.
It's also sinus season,
yeah,
which is 365 days a year, but let's move on. The exacerbating moment was a Dominican monk or priest named Tetzel, who came in to sell indulgences, especially in the area of Germany, to help build St. Peter's Basilica. Mm-hmm. And it was the use of such salesmanship as he had, which rang false for someone like Martin Luther and others who felt that it was a bad use of the gift of God's forgiveness. And how could the church use it in that way? The papacy at that time very much wanted to build St. Peter's, and it was using various means to do that. So that's the catch fire moment, coupled with Martin Luther's own passion for understanding God's forgiveness in his own life, which he had struggled with mightily. So as he opposed this bad use of God's forgiveness, or as he perceived it to be, it just started to snowball because it became not only a question of how does God forgive, but who has the power to forgive, which questions the very identity of the leadership of the church and what it's supposed to be doing.
And ultimately, really, the individual's relationship with God. That got to be a really fundamental piece of this. We are talking about the 500th anniversary of the Protestant Reformation. My guests are Father Rick Ginther. He is pastor at Our Lady of Lourdes, Indianapolis. The Reverend Nathan Wilson, Communications Director for the Christian Theological Seminary. And returning to us again, Dr. Robert Saylor, who is Executive Director of CTS's Center for Pastoral Excellence. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or track us down on Twitter at WFYI. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, Director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking about the 500th anniversary of the Protestant Reformation today on No Limits. It's a fascinating conversation about faith, good works, and really about humanity's relationship with God. My guests are Father Rick Ginther. He is current pastor at Our Lady of Lourdes, Indianapolis. The Reverend Nathan Wilson, Communications Director for Christian Theological Seminary, and Dr. Robert Saylor, who is Executive Director of CTS's Center for Pastoral Excellence. If you want to join the conversation, you can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org, find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, track us down on Twitter at WFYI, or you can do what a listener named Dave has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Dave, you're on the air.
Hi, John.
Hi.
My comment is, I guess, about organized religion in particular, but Catholicism, it seems, during the earlier stages, before the printing press was developed, they were selling indulgences on the street. The monks were handwriting the indulgences and selling them on the street for so much time out of purgatory. Once the printing press was developed, they were able to mass produce that, and it accumulated a lot of wealth within the Catholic Church, and specifically within the Medici family in Italy, in Rome. And consequently, I think they accumulated a lot of property, a lot of art, and a great deal of influence. I think the Medicis have two popes and four saints to their name. But my point is that it seems that organized religion, as a rule, has created an economy of spirit, and specifically, it revolves around forgiveness. They have control of the forgiveness aspect of spirit, and consequently, they can kind of determine and dictate what happens to you in the afterlife if you follow their rules. My point is that I don't think that we have changed a great deal socially. I think still organized religion is based on that economy of spirit, and in particular, the dollar of that economy or the currency is forgiveness. So the more you buy into the program, the more you are kind of buying your seat in heaven, so to speak. I just don't see that change a great deal. It changes its face a little bit, more liberal, more conservative. And I don't think it's just Christianity. I think there are jihadis, you know, there are conservative Christians, there are conservative Catholics, evangelists, there are conservative Jewish folks as well that I think buy into this program of being dictated what we need in order to achieve this afterlife benefit. And
Dave, let me step in and give give our guests a chance to respond here, because you've raised a lot of good points, and I do not want to let them slip by. Thank you very much for the call and for the thoughtful commentary and question. Rob.
You're welcome.
I love the phrase spiritual economies or economies of the spirit. I think that's absolutely right as a way of thinking about the various transactional natures, not only of theological ideas and concepts, but also material goods during this time. I want to riff a little bit on the irony of referring to the Reformation period as organized religion, because the simple truth is that very quickly, with the onset of the of what happens when in Wittenberg and in Europe, the Reformation quickly becomes chaotic and deeply chaotic, as Martin Luther's opponents predicted. As soon as his ideas began to gain currency, a number of other Protestant bodies began to break off from Luther, and you have the beginnings of what would become the Anabaptist traditions and so on, a number of movements that Luther himself was very bemused by, because again, his main focus was on reforming the unified Catholic Church. So the kind of chaos and disorganization that we see, not only politically, not only militarily, but also theologically and spiritually, I think actually is an enduring legacy of the Reformation. Mm-hmm. The fact that now we have a spiritual marketplace of religions mm-hmm. within the United States. Think, for instance, about excommunication. What does excommunication mean in American Christianity? If I get excommunicated from one Methodist church, I just go right down the street to a Methodist or Presbyterian one, right? Mm-hmm. What we have as a result of the Reformation is a kind of permanent state of diffusion and dissolution of church unity that only, in some ways, only within the last century has begun to be addressed within the Christian church itself.
How much of this is also a product of, at some level, historical circumstance, in that, you know, in many ways, the way the Roman Catholic Church developed was because the early Christian believers were an imperiled minority, and the church developed a real sense of social, political, economic coherence, tried to create a structure and build that community, in many ways, simply out of self-defense. And, you know, the dissolution came when, in some ways, the threat to the community wasn't perceived to be quite as great again. Father Rick, I'm going to give you the first crack at that one, but I see Nathan wants a piece of it, too, so...
Those early years of the church, the first three centuries, definitely were, you know, a time of peril. Mm-hmm. Their focus was to understand who this Jesus was and what did that mean for people's daily lives. And the conversion from how they had lived in the pagan world to this different way of living, or from the Jewish world. Many of the questions that were raised by the reformers later mm-hmm. had been discussed by the early church fathers and mothers.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes,
but a lot of those writings had just sort of slipped out of view. And so that was true within the church itself. They weren't necessarily well known. And part of what you end up with is this disconnect from that early time and understanding to the present, in part because of the development of the history within Europe itself and states, city-states, almost nations, but not quite, mm-hmm. Such that history set up, if you would, this was going to happen. Mm-hmm. If there wasn't an internal reform within the church, it was going to happen at some point. And the confusion was very evident, very quickly.
Well, and in some ways, Nathan, I'll get your thoughts too, even access to Scripture, to the Bible, at that point was sort of like access to capital today. You know, it was, you had to be at a certain level to even hope for something like that. The printing press kind of democratized things.
Right, because up to that point, you had to have wealth.
Yeah.
Or you were in a monastery setting where you had access and education.
Mm-hmm.
The common person, even the nobles, many of them didn't have access to knowledge at that level. And so you have this, for lack of a better term, hierarchy of those who knew and the mass who did not.
Mm-hmm.
And knowledge is power.
Nathan.
I think there's always been this tension for the church around issues of power. And when the church goes from a place, perhaps being the early church in many parts of the world at least, a place not in power to becoming the powerful, that's when we see some of the greatest, if you allow, sins of the church
mm-hmm.
committed. And so how it deals with being in positions of power and authority throughout history, I think, is one of the greatest tensions that we find. The caller raises some good questions, I think, around organized religion. You know, I can quip that that's why I'm a Christian Church Disciples of Christ minister. We're very disorganized, so I can try to avoid organized religion. But that's where, Rob, I might say things slightly differently than you did, and in that the structure of religion was dissolved during the Reformation period, but there's still some uniting characteristics that we have come back to in terms of theology.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm reminded while Nathan was talking of the famous Will Rogers quip mm-hmm. where he
exactly.
says, I'm not a member of any organized political party. I'm a Democrat.
Exactly.
You know, it's same principle. We've gotten an email from our regular listener, Jerry. And again, if you want to join the conversation via email, you can do so at nolimits@wfyi.org. Jerry writes, many of us secular humanists think that deities exist only in the abstract realm of mythology, but we strongly favor good works in the material world. Are these opinions okay with today's panelists? Is our religious freedom as important as theirs? Nathan, I'll stay with you on that one first.
Do I support good works?
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, and is Jerry's religious freedom as important as yours?
Absolutely. Jerry's religious freedom is as important as mine. So, and again, Luther, if not directly, at least indirectly, influences this part of the conversation as well, and that one has freedom to believe or not believe mm-hmm. what one chooses, and that there is, the founders of the United States may have gotten it a little bit wrong, mm-hmm. but in terms of attributing so much to Luther, but certainly the idea of the separation of church and state with Luther's two kingdoms, but I'm sure either of our other guests can speak about even more. His two kingdoms theology kind of gave a foundation to this ability to separate church and state.
Yeah, I can see Rob wants a piece of it.
Well, part of the story that I think needs to be told here is the fact that between the Reformers and ourselves stands the Enlightenment, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the Enlightenment is fairly directly an offshoot of the violence and the chaos that came about in the wake of the Reformation. What began as a theological dispute fairly quickly became a series of military disputes. Mm-hmm. And if you look at some of the early Enlightenment figures like Descartes, Lessing, Kant, and so on, mm-hmm. what you see is them arguing that religious opinion can no longer be the sort of catalyzing factor towards violence that they were seeing in their own mm-hmm. recent past. And so our notions of tolerance, which eventually become our notions of religious freedom, really stem fairly directly from the Enlightenment's response to the violence that was seen, you know, in the 30 Years' War and that sort of thing, immediately following in the wake of the Reformation. So even the most ardent religionist in our time, I think, has inherited a very salutary legacy of tolerance, of the fact that faith cannot be coerced, that in some ways is a legacy of the Reformation and in other ways is a corrective to it.
Is it hard for us to grasp these days that what are fairly sophisticated points of dispute would animate such high feeling in the world? I mean, 500 years ago is a long time in some ways, but in the stretch of eternity, it's really not that long. You know, that really this, these 95 theses, this idea, and, you know, really I understand it was more than the 95 theses, that there was a movement that grew out of it, though in some ways it took a meat cleaver to the world here and split it in half and kept it split for a long time. You know, is it, do you find that it's difficult to step back into that world and see where these kinds of concepts would divide people to the degree that they do? Rob, you're looking at me. You made the mistake of making eye contact, so I'll go with you first.
One of the things we have to understand about this period is that everyone was convinced that eternal salvation rested upon being in communion with the one true church.
Mm-hmm.
What becomes so existentially devastating as a result of the Reformation is that the question is raised now, where is the true church? Who has it? Is it the Roman Catholics? Is it the Lutherans? Is it the Anabaptists? Is it, and if we don't understand that salvation in the fullest sense was literally at stake for these thinkers and for these folks involved, then I think we have a hard time truly grasping the deep existential pathos of this period.
Could I,
Nathan, please.
So it gives me some hope than to think about what disputes and divisions are current that into the future we may look back on with the same kind of implicit nature of your question, John, and say,
You anticipated where I was going next. Yeah.
Apologies.
No, that's okay. It's okay. I like having smart guests. So.
I'll try to find one. so it gives me some hope then that, you know, that we could, we'll look back, or that successive generations will look back and say, oh, can you believe that they were so divided for so long about that?
Yeah, actually, and apparently a listener anticipated it, too, via Facebook. And if you want to join the conversation via Facebook, you can find us at No Limits WFYI. This listener writes, I'm a non-believer, but grew up in the Methodist Church and still find conversations about faith fascinating and enlightening, particularly conversations that bring together multiple belief systems. As we're talking about the shrinking divide between Protestants and Catholics, I'd love to hear your guests' thoughts on the benefits or drawbacks of hearing multiple voices of faith, including non-believers, on a given topic. For example, what could a Methodist gain from hearing a Catholic, Jewish, Muslim, and atheist perspective on income inequality? I'll tell you what, I'll start with Rick, but I want to hear everybody's thoughts on that. We're probably going to have to take some of it after the break.
I'm going to go with the first part. I'm not really an economist. One of the things that grew out of the Second Vatican Council in the early 1960s was this opening up of the Roman Church's understanding of how can we move towards unity with our Christian brothers and sisters, and how can we become more open to the reality of other faiths that do not acknowledge Christ as the Savior. And that began this whole dialogue mindset of building relationships first, coming to understanding, and then talking about how we are the same and how we are different. To me, that's the most important outgrowth of that has led us to this point where we are able to sit down and share. Just this last weekend, we had the Festival of Faiths downtown, where you had people of many different faith traditions, Christian and otherwise, who were in one spot just simply saying, this is who we are on a particular topic. There is more of an openness to that need for getting to know each other and allowing each other that freedom of our faith. And I think ultimately that's the focus of that's most important. Religious freedom is very real and very important.
We are talking about the 500th anniversary of the Reformation today on No Limits. My guests are Father Rick Genther, the Reverend Nathan Wilson, and Dr. Robert Saylor. I'm John Kroll. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking today about the 500th anniversary of the Reformation. My guests are Father Rick Genther, who is pastor at Our Lady of Lourdes, Indianapolis, the Reverend Nathan Wilson, who is communications director for the Christian Theological Seminary, and returning guest, Dr. Robert Saylor, who is executive director of CTS's Center for Pastoral Excellence. Before we went to the break, we had a listener who threw out the question of the benefits and drawbacks of hearing multiple voices of faith, including non-believers, on a given topic. The listener suggested even income inequality. And I said I wanted to hear everyone's thoughts. We heard Rick, but we ran out of time to get to the other. So I'll start with Nathan and give Rob the last word on that one.
Yeah, I love what Rick had to say there about how it starts with the relationships. And then from the relationships, we can more easily hear the voices of others in the dialogue. It seems to me, Aristotle said that dialogue is the art of thinking together. And so the drawbacks, and it's a great question from your listener. Mm-hmm. The drawbacks are that it's messy, mm-hmm. To take in other people's perspectives. To genuinely listen as well as talk is difficult work. It requires hard work, but it's absolutely necessary at the same time. And so whether it is across religious lines or in this case on something such as economic inequality, and you're listening to people from various faith perspectives, people of no particular faith perspective, people who are low income, people who are not, and so on. The end result, while it's difficult, while it's messy, the end result is always, it seems to me, richer than a monolithic perspective from the outset.
Yeah, let me let Rob have a word, and then I'll come back to you, Rick. Yeah.
Just two very quick points. One, the controversy over indulgences actually began as a pastoral concern for mm-hmm. Luther. He was, in addition to being a professor in Wittenberg, he was also a pastor. Mm-hmm. And he was seeing a number of his parishioners who were peasants, who had very little, giving their money over to these indulgences. And so initially the theological objection to indulgences also had a deep social justice component. And then the second thing I would say is that one of my favorite quotes from a theologian by Paul Tillich says, as Christians, we need to understand that there are multiple forms of Christianity to which atheism is superior. In other words, it's not simply a matter of affirming religion over non-religion. It's a matter of a sorting principle within religion, saying, what are the theological ideas that aid and abet human life, and what are the theological ideas that undercut mm-hmm. life? I think there are multiple forms of Christianity. I would name something like prosperity gospel mm-hmm. that actually exacerbate income inequality mm-hmm. and give aid and comfort to forces of injustice in our world. So to me, the deep Protestant impulse is to listen to as many voices as we can to sort out the ways in which theological ideas can either do good or do harm.
Rick, you wanted to come back.
One of the things that people ask me, especially parishioners, is, well, I don't understand how to be an ecumenist. How can I work in interreligious mm-hmm. relations? And the first place that I urge them to think about, first of all, the relationship with your neighbor. Do you even know them? And secondly, how are you as a Catholic in relationship to your church, who may be working with other churches or other faiths to care for the needs of the poor, mm-hmm. to speak out against inequality, injustice, discrimination. You don't have to talk about theology. Leave that to, you can, but leave it to the experts to talk about that. But how do you embody what you believe in outreach mm-hmm. and in advocacy. Mm-hmm. And that's where the common person, the common faithful person of whatever religion, that's where they can really begin to make a difference with multiple voices.
In this next question, I'm going to ask because I think it sets up how we kind of work toward reconciliation. It also has struck me that the Reformation, and I say this with, you know, only a neophyte's understanding of the forces here. I was trained as a historian, but not a religious historian. That we see, though, that the Reformation let loose a powerful impulse in humanity that seems to reassert itself periodically. That, you know, and it's now non-denominational. I don't think there has been a faith tradition, at least in the Western world and probably anywhere, that hasn't been hit with charges of either economic or moral corruption at one time or another, the hierarchy and all of that. And there is correspondingly always this movement that we want to strip away the layers here so that the individual's relationship with God can be more direct and closer. And we periodically see that over and over again, which was one of the animating principles of the Reformation itself. How has that affected the way the world has developed in this past half millennium, Rob?
I think like anything vibrant, it's a double-edged sword, right? Because on the one hand, I think you're absolutely right, John, that one of the enduring legacies of the Reformation is the sense that any individual always has the right to question institutions, question what she or he has been told, if what is at stake are deep questions of truth, beauty, and meaning, whether those happen to be religious or not. On the other hand, this focus on individualism also has a negative side in that that can easily become me only exposing myself to those people and to those opinions with whom I'm already inclined to agree. You think about what happens with news on the internet and the various algorithms to where I'm, even though I have all of this data at my fingertips, I'm actually exposed to a much smaller span of news precisely because I've said I only want to hear from these sources on these topics. So I think the trick is how do we maintain the good of this, the power of the individual to question authority, question institutions, without that becoming a kind of solipsism whereby I only expose myself to like-minded people and opinions with which I'm already inclined to agree.
Rick.
I was thinking of Pope Francis as mm-hmm. you asked the question. He is one who makes it very clear, as did Pope Benedict, Pope John Paul II, and their predecessors, that Jesus is the central core of our belief, his life, death, and resurrection, mm-hmm. and that we should have and build, especially Francis tells us this, a personal relationship with the Lord, and we've got to work towards that. But at the same time, someone like Pope Francis also says, it's all right to ask questions, and he even raises questions within the church to look at itself and say, is this the way we should be doing this? And that makes people uncomfortable, and yet at the same time, it gives us the opportunity to open up that sort of dialogue around, yes, we can talk about these various things and do it faithfully. And we might not have had that if it hadn't been in part for someone like Martin Luther, who raised the question.
Nathan.
And at the same time, it's something we continue to work toward, right? This ability for institutions, individuals as well, but especially institutions, to take a discerning look at itself and decide what it is that they do well and confess those areas that where they have fallen short. One of the Lutheran Roman Catholic bilateral dialogues had this point at the end that to call on each church body to confess the times when it has worked against the unity of the church as a part of the commemoration, and with this discerning eye of how it has in fact done things that damage the unity of the church.
And that's in some ways what we're talking about here. I anticipated where I was going with this, which is, you know, the force at some level, this desire to have a closer relationship and a closer communion with God, was at some level the impulse that split the churches in the first place. at some level, is it now the force that is bringing them back together again? Everyone wants that one, I can tell. I'll go with Rick first.
Well, John's gospel, that they all may be one, ut unum sint in the Latin, and that is just a powerful motivator to recall the very words of the Lord, I want you to be one, and that really the greatest scandal in the Western world is that Christianity is split into so many parts. We all may be one. I think that's bringing us back to where we need to be.
Nathan.
It is this, again, this self-accountability and a willingness then to allow another to call one into accountability. It takes a great degree of humility to allow someone else, again, be it an individual or another institution, to call me into accountability and to open myself up to the insight that they may give.
Rob.
If my relationship with God and if my thinking about God is entirely private, then not only is my God remarkably small, but it's almost inevitable that my God will become an idol, because my God will begin to think the way I do, hate the same people I hate.
Yeah, a reflection of yourself, basically.
Whereas when my God image is disrupted by the other, by relationship with the other, by accountability with the other, then not only does that foster human community, it also fosters a deeper understanding of who God is and the sheer breadth of God. So I think you're absolutely right, John, that what began as a desire to find God on individual terms, harnessed correctly, ought to drive us into deeper and deeper solidarity with the places where God chooses to be found. And the Gospels at least tell us that the main places where God chooses to be found are among those who precisely are on the underside of society, the poor, the weak, the marginalized. So it's not simply a matter of driving us into church community. It's a matter of driving us into solidarity with those who, like Jesus, are the victims of the forces of death in the world.
We've got a Facebook question from a listener named Jim. And again, if you want to join the conversation via Facebook, you can find us at No Limits WFYI. Jim's question kind of anticipates what we're talking about here, reflects it. He writes, it seems to me that the differences in Western Christianity have evolved not so much about Protestant and Catholic, but along the lines demarcating progressive and conservative. When I was a practicing Catholic, I had much more in common much more of a sense of community with, say, a United Church of Christ pastor or an Episcopal priest than I did with many of my fellow Catholics. In some ways, are the denominational lines now false? False barriers, because that observation has been made by many people, that often members of the political views at some level or cultural views shape the allegiance much more than the denominational ones. Rob, I'll let you go first.
I think that's right, and I think that means that it becomes less a matter of, okay, where do we draw the boundaries of a given tradition and treating them as hermetically sealed, and becomes more a matter of what are the gifts that each tradition has to offer to our common human experience? What are the gifts that a Lutheran can receive from a Catholic? What are the gifts that a Methodist can receive from a Baptist? All on the understanding that most of us walking around today are hybrids, occupying multiple of those spaces. And if you're an absolute purist about tradition, that kind of hybridity becomes a problem to be solved. If you can sort of lean in joyfully to the blurring of some of these boundaries, then the opportunity arises to receive those gifts and act on those gifts in ways that I think ultimately advance the human project.
Nathan.
Yeah. For me, the ultimate virtues are compassion and hospitality. And so where I find compassion and hospitality may, I hope, be among co-religionists and may, I hope, be among those who are not co-religionists. And so, for instance, Sometimes when I talk about immigration or immigration reform and the concept, the Abrahamic concept of welcoming the stranger, I talk about the importance of welcoming strangers who do not welcome strangers, right?
Yeah.
Which sounds great and is a good principle, except when their unwelcome of strangers begins to violate someone's rights, then that's where the line for me is drawn. And so the difficulty, as the questioner has pointed out, the difficulty becomes whether that it's within my own religion and my particular tradition within Christianity or beyond it. Either way, though, I find both the connection and the place of differentiation at that point.
Rick?
This is really naughty, but what it reminds me of just within Roman Catholicism is the fact that we're schizophrenic. Mm-hmm. On the one hand, we're considered raving liberals when it comes to social justice. On the other hand, we're considered raving conservatives when it comes to questions of personal morality.
Mm-hmm.
So that even within the Roman Church, you've got this constant tug and pull of some want to be one thing and some the other and don't want to walk the middle of the road and be in this tension. And to me, when I'm in relationship with other denominations that are Christian and other religions that grapple with these same questions, that's very comforting.
Mm-hmm.
We all struggle with them, and they don't have to drive us apart. We don't have to take sides. We have to understand and then find a way to live.
We've gotten a Facebook question that I think actually I can answer pretty quickly here because I have a question. This is from Terry, who says it's a naive and embarrassing one, but wanted to know if there's a relation between Martin Luther and Martin Luther King. The answer is sort of. Actually, Martin Luther King's father, Martin Luther King Sr., was born Michael King and changed both his and his son's name later in life as an act of homage toward Martin Luther. So this is faith is a profoundly personal thing, and this is a big, big moment. In about 10, 15 seconds, I'd just like to ask, on October 31st, this 500th anniversary, do you plan to do anything to commemorate? Real quickly, what might it be? Rob, I'll start with you.
Yeah, absolutely. In the Lutheran Church, where I'll be preaching, I think that the main thing that we'll be doing is asking the question, okay, what is God calling us to do in the next 500 years? In other words, I think it's not simply a matter of looking backwards. It's also a matter of looking forward. And as we look upon a world that is on fire in terms of economics, in terms of violence, in terms of all sorts of global turmoil, I think we'll be asking the question that hopefully animated people 500 years ago, where is God and what is God calling us to do?
And I'm afraid that will have to be the last word. I'll bring the two of you back to get your answer at another time. I'd like to thank my guests, Father Rick Genther, the Reverend Nathan Wilson, and Dr. Robert Saylor for what has been an enlightening conversation. I am John Kroll. You've been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producer, Shannon Cagle. Interactive Media Coordinator, Scott McAllister. Technical Producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And Board Engineer, Joe Hatcher. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.